Nuclear warnings. Experts who see through the stories put out by the nuclear industry have been issuing warnings about the safety of Michigan's Palisades nuclear reactor for years. It was finally closed down in May of 2022, but now new owner Holtec, which bought the reactor for scrap, is planning to bring it back online. And with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's weakened positions on safety, once operation begins, there will be no safety checks until it hits the 18-month mark. Dedicated experts continue to issue their warnings about this scheme, that steam generator pipe failures are likely, and that it could lead to catastrophic results. As usual, they have been ignored. But just last week, surprising words of support were released from Holtec's own partner, nuclear engineering contractor Framatome. And to understand the magnitude of what this means, one verifiable expert tells us.
But what happened last week is that the owner admitted that the pipes will fail before 18 months. They said if they run it for more than 14 months, there's a high probability that there'll be a pipe failure. So after 14 months, they're expecting Holtec, the people that never ran a nuclear reactor and thought they could run this one for 18 months, are now admitting that we were right, that the plant won't run 18 months.
So what does that mean? Well, when the Palisades nuclear reactor's owner warns of a potential nuclear incident, if not accident, if the reactor is allowed to restart and run, and nuclear engineer Arne Gunderson explains the current situation there, you get yet another glimpse at the hydra-headed monster industry that is the creator of that dangerous, deadly, awful seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine, keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who would like to know something, and people who know something who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, nuclear engineer Arne Gunderson provides insight into the problems at the Palisades nuclear reactor on Lake Michigan, the battle against its restart, and what's being done to fight back. We'll also hear how you can easily, personally, help eliminate investment in nukes from Susie Snyder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, with her always timely explanation of the Don't Bank on the Bomb program. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor with another story from our shared history of activist resistance to nuclear reactors and weapons, and lots more honest and verified nuclear information. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 7, 2026, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here's this week's featured interview. Heads up, Michigan! The Palisades nuclear reactor is being proposed for a restart, and that risks nuclear catastrophe. And that's why you need to pay attention. A growing body of technical evidence is raising urgent concerns about a potential double standard in nuclear safety enforcement by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. Drawing on decades of regulatory precedent, nuclear engineer and expert witness Arne Gunderson warns that the NRC is failing to apply the same rigorous inspection and root cause analysis standards at the Palisades reactor that are historically required at facilities such as Millstone Unit 1 and Turkey Point. This is about safety. The results of this move, he argues, is a dangerous erosion of safeguards designed to prevent predictable, high-consequence failures. Arne Gundersen is a nuclear engineer, whistleblower, and green energy advocate who has been a consulting expert on many nuclear reactor issues, including San Onofre here in Southern California. I spoke with Arne Gundersen on April 3rd, 2026. Arne Gundersen, it's always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's nice to be back. It's been a while.
Briefly, fill people in on what your background is in dealing with nuclear reactors.
I'll give you the elevator speech. In 1971, I got a bachelor's in nuclear. 1972, I got a master's in nuclear. I was a licensed nuclear reactor operator. And I ultimately became a senior vice president in the nuclear industry. I have a nuclear safety patent. I have three peer-reviewed papers. And the turning point in my life was when I became a whistleblower in 1990. A prominent nuclear attorney said to me, "Arne, in this business, you're either for us or against us, and you just crossed the line." Since 1990-ish, John Glenn's hearing, actually, in 1993 is when I was exonerated. Since then, I have embraced the light and renewable power.
I was going to say, you've come over from the dark side. When you started your career in 1972, you analyzed the Millstone Nuclear Reactor Unit 1 in Connecticut after a corrosion incident. What happened there, and what at the time was the response of the Atomic Energy Commission, which is the predecessor to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
Yeah, this was where I began to understand nuclear propaganda at that point. So I'm right out of college. I understood nuclear public relations for the very first time during that accident. I got out of college and I had a pretty high powered math background. And Millstone, which is in Connecticut on Long Island Sound, had a pipe rupture and it introduced salt water into the nuclear reactor. What happened was salt water is like kryptonite for stainless steel, especially hot stainless steel. And all of the monitors inside the reactor failed and the operators had no idea what the power level was. So they wrestled the plant down and the plant was shut down for about 8 months. And I was given the job of trying to analyze what the hell had happened. I'd like to think it was because I was a good engineer, but in fact, I was the only guy who could remember differential equations. So I made a presentation to the NRC in November of 72. We are talking 54 years ago. And I explained the analysis I had done. Now, here's where the public relations came in. I wrote the report saying that Millstone had an accident, and it was a severe saltwater leak. They told me to throw out that paper and retype it. This is back when stuff was typed. And it wasn't an accident. It was an incident. And it wasn't a severe saltwater leak. It was a chloride intrusion. So... And they still do it today. When you see the word intrusion, it comes up about once a year. I think back, I said, oh my God, they're trying to frame the argument to make it so mundane that nobody gives a damn. So this crap got into the nuclear reactor, caused the stainless steel pipes to break and develop cracks. Millions of dollars later, the plant started back up under a very strict inspection regime from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We could only run for 1 month. We had to shut it down again and go back and look at everything. So that was a formative piece technically. It was really cool math. But more importantly, it really began to affect my worldview on how to frame an argument.
You also worked on Turkey Point in Florida in the late 1970s. What were the findings there? And this time, how did the NRC, which had already replaced the Atomic Energy Commission, how did the Nuclear Regulatory Commission respond?
It's interesting because, again, now we're talking 76 is when a pipe broke in the steam generator at Turkey Point. They had a 30-gallon a minute leak. The Millstone leak was 60 gallons a minute. That's a lot of water, gallon every 2 seconds. It was shut down. It was reinspected. And they found that the steam generators were developing something called stress corrosion cracking. And the same stress corrosion cracking that had occurred on Millstone. And it's interesting because the old AEC on Millstone, changed the name to the NRC, insisted that the plant be shut down every 6 months for reinspection to make sure this stress corrosion cracking wasn't growing faster than they estimated.
This was a safety factor that they were instituting.
Yes. Yeah. If these pipes break, it allows radiation to go out into the environment. And 30 gallons a minute is a lot of radiation. So they were very concerned about the public health and safety in Florida. The response to the Atomic Energy Commission at Millstone in 72, they changed the name, and the response to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at Turkey Point in 76 was dramatic. They really gave a damn about not starting the plant back up, but when it started up, they forced it to shut back down again and be frequently reinspected. So that's in my background, my 50 years ago, Arne Gundersen background. These were formative events, and that's back when safety used to mean something.
Now, there are problems at the Palisades nuclear facility in Michigan. Start with a history of the site and what's been going wrong and what's wrong now.
Okay, well, Palisades is an ancient reactor. The engineering on it started when I was in ninth grade, and it went online in 71. It ran. It didn't run well, but it ran without serious public health impacts until 2022. There were two owners, but the last owner was a company called Entergy, and they had 11 different power plants and seemed to know a little bit more about nuclear power than the current owner. So in 2022, the plant was shut down for good because Entergy was on a subsidy to keep this plant running, and the subsidy ran out. They were being paid by the state to keep the plant running. And when the state stopped paying, they shut it down. They sold it for scrap. They sold it to be destroyed to a company called Holtec that had never operated a nuclear plant before, but they were a scrap dealer. So Holtec closed the plant down and let it sit for 2 years and never took care of the water chemistry in the pipes. They were going to knock it apart. So it didn't matter if the pipes rusted or became contaminated or anything. And then 2 years later, in 2024, they decided, oh my God, we can make a lot of money if we start this plant back up. Now, remember, it shut down because it was subsidized. And now they've gotten about $2 billion in subsidies.
From who?
The comment is Holtec runs on opium, OPM, other people's money. So they are highly subsidized to get the plant fixed up. And then once they start up, they're still going to be need to be subsidized. So they're more expensive than renewables than the alternative. Anyway, the pipes are crapped up because they didn't have the right chemicals in the water. And when they decided to start back up, this is in 2024, they went in and inspected the pipes in the steam generator. That's a huge 100-ton vertical tank with pipes inside it. And they found 250 times more damage than when they had bought the plant 2 years earlier. And the pipes were, guess what, stress corrosion cracking. So here I am, I'm this guy who 55 years ago was working on the same damn problem, stress corrosion cracking in a nuclear plant. And here's Palisades with stress corrosion cracking both in the steam generators and in the nuclear reactor. And what caught my attention was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Their response was entirely different. 50 years ago, they were relatively tough. They insisted that it be shut down frequently for reinspections. And here at Palisades, with 250 times more damage than 2 years before, they just don't care. They were allowing it to run for 18 months without an inspection.
What has changed about the perception of the problems there in the last week?
I've been saying there's problems there for 2 years with Don't Waste Michigan and Beyond Nuclear as the litigants. I've been their expert. And so we have been highlighting these pipe failures for 2 years now. But what happened last week is that the owner admitted that the pipes will fail before 18 months. They said if they run it for more than 14 months, there's a high probability that there'll be a pipe failure. And what that means is that we were right. And the other part of it is they're saying it will exponentially increase after 14 months. So that means it grows up a little, and then all at once it grows suddenly. So after 14 months, they're expecting Holtec, the people that never ran a nuclear reactor and thought they could run this one for 18 months, are now admitting that we were right, that the plant won't run 18 months. Frankly, I don't believe their 14-month number either, but it's heartening as an expert to have the other side admit that your analysis was right. Of course, they didn't give me credit, but that's okay.
Well, we will.
Thank you.
Nuclear hot seat is where it really counts. Since this report, which was released on March 19, what impact has this had on Holtec, and what impact, either possible or already existing, has it had on your lawsuits?
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission for 2 years has been absolutely silent on all of the work we've done. The commission staff has a special group whose goal is to get Palisades restarted. And to give you an idea how important that group is, during the government shutdown, it was the only thing in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that was running. The Trump administration is insisting that Palisades be restarted. So going into the Holtec report, they have been, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. I have written, maybe 100 pages of expert reports outlining the problems. And I've written to the NRC legal people, to their technical people, and also to the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards, the 16 wise people who, in theory, are independent. And it's like they're whistling past the graveyard. They have been totally non-responsive to anything I've written. So then this Holtec report drops, and I reviewed it. My eyes bugged out because they were agreeing with us. Now, we filed yesterday. We filed, that's Tuesday, April 2nd, we filed. And we filed it differently this time. Instead of going through the legal mumbo-jumbo of mailing it into the formal commission route, we mailed it to the 40 engineers who are working on the project individually. And the theory is that maybe one of them might actually read the damn thing. We haven't heard back. It's only been 2 days. And my guess is we won't hear back, but at least I'm reminded of those, the Morton Thiokol engineers on the Challenger disaster. They knew that booster was going to blow. And one of them actually watched the rocket lift off, and he said to his wife before liftoff, it's going to explode. So yeah, I go to bed knowing there's going to be a radiation release at a minimum, and possibly a real serious radiation release. And I got to try my best. And so I'm just trying my best. And if the government doesn't do anything about it, I tried my best. And that's really where I have to leave it.
How bad would a radiation release from Palisades be? And what might it do to the people living in the surrounding area?
Holtec would have to initiate the emergency plan and begin evacuations. Now, that's not something that anybody in the nuclear industry wants to do, but if they were to follow their own instructions as the leak develops, they would have to evacuate out 5 or 10 miles. I suspect they'll do what the engineers did at 3 Mile Island. And they would reevaluate for about a day or two their calculations. And in the meantime, the radioactive gas cloud would have dissipated. So I don't think Holtec will behave honorably or legally. But if they were to be honorable and legally enforce their own emergency procedures, they would have to evacuate out to 10 miles.
And of course, radiation doesn't go, oh, 10 miles, can't cross that line.
Right.
So it would be going further than that.
Now, this is in the state of Michigan. It's on the west coast of Michigan, up against the lake. And on the eastern side is Detroit. And a little further south is Chicago. So we are talking about a nuclear plant in the breadbasket of America. The best situation would be a pipe begins to leak, but not break. In which case they would shut down, they'd find all sorts of cracks and have to shut down for 2 years until they replace these components. But the worst case is a pipe grossly fails and they would have to evacuate out to 10 miles. Yeah.
Is there anything that the listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat and other concerned individuals can do to help promote some sanity on the part of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission making decisions on this?
The best possibility is to work with the Michigan legislature. They've already subsidized this plant to the tune of $300 million. And that's the state of Michigan has thrown $300 million at it. And Department of Energy has thrown another roughly $2 billion at it. The most likely possibility of change is to influence the legislature in Michigan. So, if any of your listeners are in Michigan, talk to your local representatives, not the national representatives, the people who are in the state house, and say, hey, what are we doing? You're giving us money to a company, other people's money, opium, to a company that's never run a nuclear plant before. After you've given it the money, we're still going to pay 2 or 3 cents more a kilowatt than we would have if we had wind turbines. What's going on here? So I think there's an opportunity to change the dialogue at the State House and take away that funding. As long as the president administration's in Washington, Department of Energy is going to throw money at it. And I hold no hope out that we'll begin to. Now, it could be a radiation release with an evacuation out to 10 miles and everybody comes back in a week, but it could be a meltdown. And I leave the blame squarely on the current political administration. This thing is being fast-tracked, and whatever guardrails there were, and I've never been convinced there's a lot of guardrails, but whatever guardrails there were have been destroyed. Hell, Trump has thrown out two commissioners on the NRC, and these guys were plain white bread. They certainly weren't radicals, and they didn't push the company line.
Is there anything you'd like to add to this discussion?
Well, there's a great piece that just came out. ProPublica just published a great piece, and hopefully, maybe you can put it up on your site. But it analyzes the Washington Post and what they're saying about nuclear power. Now, Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos. And Amazon is interested in data centers and owns a nuclear company. So its data center company and its nuclear company are part of the NEI, Nuclear Energy Institute. And all at once, the editorial policy of the Washington Post has shifted to be very pro-nuclear. It's a phenomenal piece of reporting, and it really shows about the insidious nature of the connection between the broligarchs who are pushing artificial intelligence and the nuclear regulators. It's a phenomenal expose.
We will link to that on the webpage for this episode, number 771. Arne Gundersen, it's always a pleasure and extremely revelatory to have you as a guest on Nuclear Hot Seat, and I thank you for joining us this week.
Thanks, Libby. Nice to be here.
Nuclear engineer Arne Gundersen. On our website, we will have links up to the press release sent out by Don't Waste Michigan, which goes through all the talking points we mentioned and many more, and contact information for two of its lead people, Michael Keegan and Kevin Camps. We'll also have a link up to the ProPublica article, Washington Post Promotes Nuclear Agenda Tied to Bezos Investments, so you can check that one out for yourself as well. Want to know how you can help stop nuclear proliferation and do it from your home, and it costs you no money and just a little bit of time? We'll have that information coming up in our next interview in just a moment. But for now, on April 7, 2026, in a post on Truth Social, U.S. President Donald Trump stated that, quote, "A whole civilization will die tonight," end quote, adding that it would, quote, "never be brought back again," end quote. That's the threat of genocide being sent out by one man who has the power to almost instantaneously make it happen, because as commander-in-chief, he holds sole absolute authority to order the use of nuclear weapons. And he can authorize a nuclear strike without consulting Congress, the cabinet, or military officials, and there is no legal veto power existing over this decision. That's nuclear blackmail, not only of the people of Iran and their country. In truth, it's blackmail for the planet. Because what happens when a nuke goes off does not stay where the nuke went off. It circles the globe, gets into the jet stream, gets into our food and water, and stays in the air, breaks our DNA, and contaminates life itself. That's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We unconditionally support the movement to get rid of nuclear weapons and the nuclear reactors that support them. To that end, every week, we call out nuclear lies and liars through interviews and news stories with genuine experts, while letting you know what frontline activists and movements are doing around the world. We provide verifiable nuclear news so that you can understand the issues, the manipulations, and what you can do about it. But in order to keep doing this show, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and we're always in need of your support. Be it a one-time donation of any amount or a recurring donation of as little as $5, that's the same as you would spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee, all of it counts towards meeting our monthly expenses. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com, and that way, no fees are taken out. So don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now, and know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's second featured interview. How do we stop nuclear weapons from being manufactured in the first place? Follow the money, and then stop it. And there's something easy that any one of us can do to dry up nuclear's financial pipeline at no cost to you and requiring very little time. To learn more, listen as Susie Snyder explains. She is the Director of Programs at the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, where her responsibilities include facilitating the development and execution of ICAN's key programs. This includes management of ICAN's divestment work and engagement with the financial sector. For more than a decade, Susie coordinated the Don't Bank on the Bomb divestment project. She is an expert on nuclear weapons with over two decades' experience working at the intersect between nuclear weapons and human rights. We spoke about this initially on May 10, 2019. Her information is as relevant now as it was then, and know that the report on nuclear bomb-producing companies that she references is updated every year with the most current information available. So whatever year you hear her saying, just substitute this one. Note that there will be a brief, unplanned appearance of a young activist who underscores the reason why we do this work.
Susie Snyder, thank you so much for being with us here today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
First of all, what is PAX and what are the organization's goals?
Well, PAX is a Dutch peace organization, and what we're doing, we are working to reduce human suffering as a result of conflict. And so to prevent war, prevent suffering, and generally to make sure that we build norms that keep people safe and keep people alive.
What are some of your cornerstone programs? I'm certainly familiar with Don't Bank on the Bomb because I've followed that protocol with my own finances. What is this and how can people participate in it?
Don't Bank on the Bomb is a great project. What we do is we do three things. We examine the impact of the financial sector on companies that produce nuclear weapons. We name those companies, name them and shame them, and we encourage people to get in touch with their financial institutions so that they develop policies so that they don't have any exposure to these companies that do produce the key components for nuclear bombs. So it's naming the ones that have investments, it's supporting the ones that have great policies not to invest, and it's, of course, identifying the companies that make the bombs, because if we don't know who's doing it, we don't know what we can do about it.
Speaking of those companies, there has just been a new report that came out naming 28 separate companies as being involved in the manufacture of nuclear weapons. How did that report come about and what are some of the findings you've made because of it?
Well, let me tell you, Libby, it was a good deal of research and we are extremely rigorous in our research. So we've been looking at contracts and announcements for contracts, requests for proposals and so on for the last 6 months. And so what we did is, as we looked at these, different issues, and we, I'm sure that many of your listeners also have children.
it's
they're hearing in the background.
Susie, this is the reason we do the work that we do for the children and beyond. So this could not be more perfect.
It is just the reality, you know, working moms everywhere. Anyway, so what we did is we looked at the contracts, we looked at the government plans, different government plans for new types of nuclear weapons, for the weapons that are under these so-called modernization programs. And then we looked to see, okay, who's actually doing this in-house, so to speak? Like what countries are doing it? There's only 9 countries that have nuclear weapons, right? It's not so many at the end of the day. And we look at who does stuff in-house using state-run agencies and who contracts out. Now, not everybody contracts out. Russia does stuff mostly in-house. North Korea does everything in-house. Pakistan does stuff in-house, but India, the US, the UK, France, they all hire external contractors. So then we follow the money. Who bids on the contracts? Who gets the contract? And what are they doing? What are they actually doing under these contracts? And that's what we found exciting. Well, it's exciting in a in not a nice way, to be honest. But we found that, you know, we found over $116 billion in existing contracts right now for keeping nuclear weapons on the planet. And some of them until 2075, which all of these countries have said, their heads of state at one time or another said, no, we need a world without nuclear weapons. And I'll tell you, you don't get to a world without nuclear weapons by hiring Boeing or Raytheon or Lockheed Martin to build a new nuclear arsenal for you.
Some of the stories that I've read about coming out from the contracts are truly, it's like going into bizarro land. Give us some examples. For example, when the head of Raytheon was asked if there was a growth opportunity in the U.S. exit from the INF treaty.
So this was really surprising. I mean, okay, usually with nuclear weapons, nobody's really, at least nobody should be really proud to be making nuclear weapons. These are weapons designed to, you know, your listeners know this already. These are weapons designed to annihilate cities. They're not for battlefields. They're not for strategic pinpoint accuracy. This is a city buster. And that's, I think that's really important to keep in mind. And for the most part, over the last, almost the last generation, people have been shying away from taking pride in this, but then there are a few. And there's been a slight change in the rhetoric around this. So when, you know, Donald Trump took office, he asked these questions, why would we have nuclear weapons if we could never use them? And he started saying, well, maybe we need, you know, we need to go back to make more and the biggest and the best weapons. And he's basically inciting an arms race by withdrawing from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, this treaty from 1987 that prohibited an entire class of weapons. He opened the floodgates on this. And so in Raytheon, and Raytheon of all companies, Raytheon kind of was getting out of the nuclear arms game. It was seen as a losing interest. But then the withdrawal from the INF came about and they said, oh, wait, we might have an opportunity here, at least in the short term. So you saw the investor relations call. They said, they were asked the question, oh, yeah, you know, is there any opportunity for us? And over the next quarter, Raytheon got $500 million in new contracts related to missile technology. So Raytheon's starting to cash in on this new nuclear arms race. And I just have to ask the question, what are they, you know, they're only looking for short-term game. What are they looking for in the long term? Because this is not the kind of product that we should be supporting.
It's a terrifying thought that nuclear weapons are looked at as a growth industry and an opportunity for investor profits, when really their end game is the destruction of everything and their profits will mean nothing. There are other programs that have been brought up in the reading that I've been doing. And another one had to do with Boeing and a new program that the company that brought us the twice crashed 737 MAX is being asked to develop. What is a flight termination receiver and what are the implications of the attempt to develop it?
Okay, so this is something that within the nuclear policy community, there's some debate, right? So the flight termination receiver is, the idea is you can call the missile back because it takes about, between 25 and 40 minutes for an intercontinental ballistic missile to be launched and hit its target. And that means that once you press the button, there's 2 hours until the end of civilization as we know it, because any target, they're gonna see the incoming missile and they're gonna launch in return. They're going to try to take everything out before you take out what they've got. There was this whole concept behind mutually assured destruction. So with what Boeing is doing now is they're making this new missile technology so that if you launch and you decide, oh, wait, whoops, our information was wrong. Oh, actually, it was a weather balloon. Oh, no, that wasn't an incoming missile. It was, you know, it was a pigeon. You know, whatever it is, and I don't mean to make light of it, but seriously, there's been so many near misses. It could be anything. The idea is that the missile would then go off course or would self-destruct. So it wouldn't have the same, it wouldn't hit its target. So the idea is to be able to shift it in flight. Now, on the one hand, you know, this could be great because then it, you know, it won't hit its target and you could stop some insanity. But on the other hand, if you see the missile coming in, you're going to fire with everything you've got. And so it's a losing situation. It's a losing proposition. And honestly, as you said, with the everyday, how much can we trust Boeing right now?
It's how much do we trust anybody who is working in nuclear arms because they can somehow justify it. I've also seen that one of the problems with having a flight termination receiver is that it might call for a launch of a weapon and then using it just as a scare tactic because they think, well, we can pull it back and there will be no harm, no foul, when indeed, you're right, the retaliation could be volleyed out before we could pull it back, and they might not be able to do so. And there goes the planet, or if not the planet, at least the people and the life forms on it.
Exactly. And what we've learned from new climate research, from new modeling over just the last 10 years, is that it doesn't take 1,000 bombs going off to destroy the civilization that we know. It would take 100 weapons between, for example, India and Pakistan, and 2 billion people. 2 billion people would be at risk of famine. It would cause grave environmental catastrophe. It would be a nuclear winter. And in the 80s, we were totally aware of this. We're like, okay, this is not going to happen. We're going to stop it. We're going to shut this down. This is insane. And right now, it's our time to stand up and say, hey, this is insane. There are so many more things that we could spend the money on. The US government alone is spending $70,000 a minute on producing nuclear weapons. $70,000 a minute. Imagine what $70,000 a minute could do for public education, addressing climate change. The nuclear weapons problem, it's complicated, but it's a relatively easy fix. And it's just a matter of deciding to do it. And now's the time for people to demand that we do.
You know, you're right. On the one hand, it's a terribly depressing image for those of us who oppose nuclear and have managed to become conscious about it. Yet, in the intertwining of the private sector and nuclear weapons, there are potential points of leverage. Explain what you mean by that.
This is what I'm finding is very exciting. So 2 years ago, most of the nations in the world adopted a new treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. They said, you know what? This has gone bonkers long enough. And the consequences of any use of nuclear weapons are so grave. We need to prohibit everything to do with them. Prohibit all the making, having, using, preparing to use, prohibit it. Make it illegal. Make sure that we are collectively responsible if any weapons get used. You know, reinforce the non-proliferation standard by doing so. Protect the environment. This is true. Most governments in the world said, yes, we're going to do this. And after that, financial institutions, banks, pension funds, insurance companies, they said, wait a minute. If the weapons are illegal, the companies that are making the weapons, they're going to start to go down. Let's get out now. Let's prevent any reputational risk or regulatory risk. Let's end our financial involvement with these companies. And 10% of them dropped out. It was amazing.
When you said 10% of them dropped out, explain a little more about what that exactly means.
We've been doing this kind of analysis of the involvement of the financial sector and nuclear weapon producers for a while now, since 2013. And we track every year how many banks and how many financial institutions invest. And from the adoption of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons until a year later, there was a 10% reduction. In actual numbers, there's 30 fewer financial institutions that had investments in the companies that produce nuclear weapons. And some of these are really, like, this is Blue Cross and Blue Shield that previously had some investments and then got out. This is, you know, the Norwegian government pension funds that said, oh, wait a minute, we better change our relationship here. This is ABP, which is the fifth largest pension fund in the world. And they said, oh, hang on. Nope, nuclear is illegal now. Got to get out of that game, which is quite impressive. And we're putting together the numbers for this year. And I think we're going to see some additional positive change. Even though a few companies are starting to make money off of new contracts, in most of the world, this is seen as a bad investment.
I often think of PACS and the Nobel Peace Prize winning International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, which was behind the treaty in the United Nations, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. I often think of you two as kind of either conjoined or somehow being under the same umbrella. What is the relationship between the two groups?
PACS is a partner of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and ICAN is a campaign coalition, and we've got over 500 partners in more than 100 countries around the world. And it was ICAN working with these partnerships, also with concerned governments, with international organizations like the Global Red Cross, that got this treaty to happen. It was through partnership. It was through a movement. And PACS is a part of this bigger movement. We're really proud to be a member of this campaign coalition, because it means that we're, as we said in the local papers here, the Nobel Peace Prize got won in our little town, at least a little bit. It's quite amazing.
Let's switch over to talking a little bit about ICAN and the impact that that is having and can potentially have on the entire nuclear weapons landscape in the world. It is not a campaign to ask the 9 nuclear countries to get rid of their weapons. It's a campaign to get all of the countries that don't have nuclear weapons to agree to not get nuclear weapons. And then there are other provisions involved with it as well. Can you explain what those are and how those would mess up the nuclear countries?
Sure. So the thing is with ICAN is that we're working in over 100 countries to raise the stigma against nuclear weapons. And most countries of the world have already rejected nuclear weapons. It's just this 9 that seem to be a bit stuck and seem to be kind of it's a little bit of old thinking, and that doesn't quite relate to the current world order. But the ICAN is working even in the nuclear armed countries to say, hey, we have a plan to get to no nuclear weapons in the world. We know the nuclear armed countries, they're clearly not ready yet. They haven't quite matured to the level of many others to be able to take a more realistic and pragmatic approach to their security. But the other countries have. And so countries like Austria and Ireland, South Africa, are fully on board with this treaty because they recognize that there is no benefit to them and only risk from supporting nuclear weapons. What this means is that financial institutions in those countries have seen what happens with other weapons prohibitions, and they get out of the game when it comes to investing in companies that produce the weapons. Companies like Airbus. Airbus is a Dutch registered company. Airbus has operations throughout Europe. Airbus is known for making airplanes. Airbus also makes missiles for the French nuclear arsenal. And what this does is it says that if Airbus, for example, when Germany signs on to the ban treaty, the operations that Airbus has within Germany can't be involved in the production of missiles for France or for anybody else, because that's prohibited under the treaty. And that would change the landscape for France. France doesn't have another capability, or that they have to move manufacturing capabilities. And that's really important. And also, the treaty also has this great impact because it makes the question of, it challenges the assumption that nuclear weapons benefit anyone's security, and in fact puts the onus on those who have the weapons to prove it. You've been saying this for so long with no evidence. You've been, you know, quite hysterical about your security concerns. No, be rational, be calm, prove that this is the only way forward. And if it is in fact the only way forward, why are you so united against other countries getting the same weapons? Why does North Korea use the same language as France in defending its decision to get nuclear weapons? You know, be a calm, rational actor in this field and not the hysterical nuclear-armed countries that we've come to know.
It seems that this program, the Treaty for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and the countries that sign on to it would really signify a grassroots erosion of the ability of the nuclear industry to operate unimpeded. In other words, putting perhaps if not a block in the road, a stone in the shoe, that they can't move forward as they planned on it. And here in the U.S., we are starting to see some changes, at least on the state and the local level. In January, a bill was introduced in the Massachusetts state legislature that would require the state's pension funds to divest from nuclear manufacturers. The city of Cambridge has already done so, and here in California, OHI will not make any future investments in the makers or funders of nuclear weapons. Do you think that the best way for us to proceed is to work on the local grassroots level rather than going for the big guys in Washington, D.C., or the heads of whatever countries, people listening to this show in 123 countries that listen to it, not going after the top of the governmental food chain, but starting local is the path we need to follow?
Well, I think it depends on where people are. So in the U.S., you know, one out of every eight Americans lives in California. So when the California state legislature passes a resolution calling on the U.S. federal government to endorse and embrace the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, that is significant. And that is a demonstration of the will of the people. Nuclear weapons are the opposite of democracy. They are the opposite of people's movements. And it's going to take people's movements being creative in the locations they are to get change. We just had today, which said Berlin, both the city of Berlin as well as the federal state of Berlin come on board and call on the German government to join this treaty.
Oh, that's fabulous. I hadn't gotten that news yet.
Yeah, and it's happening every day. There are new cities joining. There's new state resolutions being discussed. There are conversations happening. And the key thing is, nuclear weapons are an anachronism, and we can move past them, but we have to talk about them. And we have to talk about them not just with our friends that it's comfortable to talk about them with. We have to talk about them in other places. And reach out, because I'll tell you, we ran a petition campaign a couple of years ago in the Netherlands. And what we found is that 9 out of every 10 people we asked said, of course we don't support nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are dumb. Wait, they're still a problem? I thought they were gone. Most people don't know. And as soon as they know, they think, oh my gosh, this is ridiculous. This is a problem of the 80s. Let's send it to the dustbin of history. That attitude and that emphasis and that enthusiasm is starting to catch like a wildfire throughout the world. And it will change the minds of those sitting in the high political offices. If you are friends with the head of state, by all means, call your buddy and tell them to get on board with this treaty. If, however, you are not friends with the head of state, think about other ways you can help support this effort to make nuclear weapons history.
That brings us to the practicalities. What are things that people on the ground can do, and what tools do you have? Because the research is extensive and it is impeccable. Everything is footnoted. Everything is accurate in it. Because our side can't afford to make mistakes. What do you have available that we can use to support anything that we are saying or doing on the ground?
Well, the first thing I would encourage your listeners to just sign up to our newsletter. We're constantly putting information out. It's at nuclearban.org. And there's tons of info there. Well, now, it depends, again, where people are. If you want to figure out how to make sure your personal finances are in no way connected to the companies that produce nuclear weapons, whether it be through your bank or through your pension investment or other things, we have checklists on our website for people to use. So just, you know, quickly scan the website, see if your bank's listed, send them a message. We have tools. You can directly send your bank a message. And a lot of people these days, myself included, do banking on our phones, right? Mobile banking is like the thing. And I encourage people all the time, pull out your phone, go to your banking app, and just send a message directly to your bank right now. And just say, hey, are we in any way connected to companies that produce nuclear bombs? When you ask that question through your mobile app, through walking into your local bank branch, whatever it is, you're starting a chain reaction of the good kind. The person on the other end probably has no idea.
So they're going to have to ask somebody, is going to have to ask somebody, is going to have to ask somebody. We saw a number of financial institutions get out of this type of investment because people started asking questions on their Facebook profiles. And there's like, oh, that's not good. We can't have this. Oh, wait, let's check. Okay, well, let's get that. They divested first, and then they put into place a policy to make sure that they'll never have any kind of investments and connected to nuclear weapon producers in the future. And it's part of their internal due diligence now. It wasn't a huge number of people that did this. It was three or four people that saw something in the newspaper, that saw a tweet, that heard something on the radio. And they took action because it truly is, as Margaret Mead said, it truly is a small handful of thoughtful and committed people that can change the world. And there are many people who would love the extra energy and attention and the quick question, do we have anything to do with the nuclear bomb? If so, how can we avoid it? And we can, and we will.
The brilliance of this program is that any individual can make an enormous difference simply by taking a few steps that are already brilliantly strategized and plotted out and framed, as you have done, as the people with PACs have done, and I can as well. If you have any final thoughts to share with the listeners today, what would that be?
I would ask your listeners to tell a friend. Each one can reach one and each one can teach one. And that is how we will get this change. And that is how we will be able to retire from working on nuclear weapon issues and put our energy into dealing with the new challenges that face a new century.
Susie Snyder, you have been doing brilliant work. I've been aware of your work since Helen Caldicott's conference. I believe it was 5 or 6 years ago. And the progress has been astonishing and breathtaking. I always report on any positive steps that we find out that have been taken by either PACs or ICANN on Nuclear Hot Seat, because we've got to get our new good news from somewhere. And it seems to come inordinately from these two groups.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you. It's always a great pleasure. And I really appreciate the opportunity today.
And I appreciate you being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
I love this woman's energy. Susie Snyder. When we spoke in 2019, she was still coordinator of the Don't Bank on the Bomb project. She is now director of programs at the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. On our website, we will have a link up to Don't Bank on the Bomb and the most current report. That will be nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 771. And if you run across any information on a company that's making parts for nuclear weapons and it's not on their list, do let them know, and they will do the research necessary to find out current information and add it to their report for next year. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 7, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's an easy thing to do. What's best for us and our Google algorithm is to sign up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com. You go there, you will see a yellow opt-in box. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will receive one email with the link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a brief outline of some of the material that's in it. It's the perfect way to make certain that you never miss a single update that we send out about what's happening in the world from a nuclear perspective. Another way you can help is if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you once again that as Commander-in-Chief, the President of the United States, currently Donald Trump, who has explicitly threatened genocide against Iran, which is a war crime, Donald Trump currently holds sole absolute authority to order the use of nuclear weapons and can authorize a nuclear strike without consulting Congress, the cabinet, or military officials, and there is no legal veto power existing over this decision. If that's not a wake-up call, I don't know what is. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep. And take an action, any action you can. Why? Because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.